Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Proverbs chapter 11, which I will call the Proverbs of Solomon, part 2. It is hard to give a chapter title to these chapters because they are collections of Solomon's Proverbs, and oftentimes the Proverbs don't really have anything to do with each other. And so we'll just call this chapter Proverbs of Solomon, part 2. We start with verse 1. Solomon says, "A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight." The false balance, of course, represents all crooked business dealings. Adam Clark says, "A false balance is created by one beam being longer than the other." You can imagine how that would work. It's above the scriptures. Solomon says in Proverbs 16:11, "A just balance and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights of the bag are his concern." Proverbs 20:10, Solomon says, "Differing weights and differing measures, both of them are abominable to the Lord." Proverbs 20:23, Solomon says, "Differing weights are an abomination to the Lord, and a false scale is not good." Moses said the same thing in Leviticus 19:35-36 in the law, "You shall do no wrong in judgment, in measurement of weight or capacity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin." A hin was a liquid measure. Ephah was a solid measure. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt." Now, every nation has weights that are standard. That's one of the first things a modern government does. Back in the 1900s, for example, or the 1800s, 1700s even, you get a standard weight, standard measure. Now, how can people have false weights? For example, you have a weight that's labeled as 100 grams, but it's actually 120 grams. You put it on the scale and you say, "Buyer, put some gold on the scale to equal 100 grams. The buyer puts 100 grams on the scale, and the 100 grams is not enough to lift the 120 gram weight. So the buyer puts another 20 grams on the scale. He thinks he has put 100 grams on the scale, but he's actually put 120 grams of gold on the scale, and he has been cheated. We go now to Proverbs 11:2. Solomon says, "When pride comes, then comes dishonor, but with the humble is wisdom." Now, this proverb is very similar to our saying, "Pride goes before a fall." Here's some other scriptures that say the same thing. Solomon says in Proverbs 16:18, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling." Proverbs 18:12, "Before destruction, the heart of man is haughty, but humility goes before honor." Solomon says in Proverbs 15:33, "The fear of the Lord is the instruction for wisdom, and before honor comes humility." Proverbs 29:23, "A man's pride will bring him low, but a humble spirit will obtain honor." Jesus himself said in Matthew 23:12, and in the parallel synoptic gospel Luke 14:11, "Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted." Just look back in your life and think of all the proud people that you know that have fallen. I remember one particular proud family in a small southern town. Somebody I know, the family I knew, they were from the richest people in town. One of the sons of that family was in my class. I knew him. He was fabulously wealthy. He is now living hand to mouth with not a penny to his name. His father went bankrupt. This man would take me to the former governor's mansion in a particular state, and I would look at all the fine furniture and tapestries and columns, and I felt like a nothing burger because of the pride that was exuded from this family. And I feel nothing but sympathy for him now because it was tragic as they lost everything. We go down to Proverbs 11:3. Solomon says, "The integrity of the upright will guide them, but the crookedness of the treacherous will destroy them." How does the crookedness of the treacherous destroy the treacherous? Well, we have an English metaphor that expresses this. He was hoisted his own petard. Remember in the book of Esther, Haman, the evil counselor of Xerxes, Ahasuerus, he built a petard. That was a gallows. He built it for Mordecai, but as the story unfolds, Haman was exposed, Mordecai was elevated, and Mordecai ended up hanging Haman on the same petard that Haman had built. Haman was hoisted on his own petard. That's the classic example. It's even made it into the English language. We go now to Proverbs 11:4. Solomon says this, "Wealth is worthless in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death." What kind of death is referred to here by Solomon? Could be eternal death, could be temporal death. If it's temporal death, of course, sometimes that's not the case, because sometimes righteous people die prematurely. Remember the book of Hebrews chapter 11. But if it's eternal death, that's absolutely true. If we're righteous before God, we will never, ever die. But for the wicked, wealth is worthless in the day of wrath. That again could be temporal wrath that God is visiting upon the wealthy, wicked person. But it could be judgment day. The coin of the rich man is not legal tender in God's economy, and he will expire, go shuffling off into hell, because his sins were not covered by the blood of the Lamb. We go down to Proverbs 11:5. Solomon says, "The righteousness of the blameless makes a straight way for them, but the wicked are brought down by their own wickedness." Now, this is another example of a hoisted on his own petard scripture. There's lots of them. Here's some examples. Psalms 9:16. "The Lord has revealed himself. He has executed justice, striking down the wicked by the work of their hands." The wicked's work is what ends up nailing them. Psalms 9:16 is David's psalm, so like father, like son, Solomon is saying the same thing. Wickedness will get you in the end, your own wickedness. Solomon says in Proverbs 5:22, "A wicked man's iniquities entrap him. He is entangled in the ropes of his own sin." In general, folks, sin does not pay. Now, what about the lament? Why do the wicked prosper? I don't have the psalm in front of me, but it's one of the psalms. Why do the wicked prosper? Well, here are two answers to that. First of all, the wicked don't prosper forever. They might prosper all the way till they die in this life, but then they face eternal destruction in hell, so they're not prospering. And besides, I would say that some of the wicked, in fact, many of the wicked, don't prosper in this life. Sometimes they end up in jail or they end up dead. So as a good general rule, don't think that you're going to prosper when you see the wicked prosper. Their time is coming. Proverbs 11:6, Solomon says, "The righteousness of the upright delivers them, but the unfaithful are trapped by evil desires." Now, the deliverance of the upright is probably referring to deliverance from evil desires. If you use parallelism to compare the first and last half of the verse, the unfaithful are trapped by evil desires, the upright are delivered from evil desires. And of course, that shows that evil desires will trap you. The wages of sin is death, bondage, the bondage of sin. Proverbs 11:7, Solomon says, "When a wicked man dies, his hope perishes. All he expected from his power comes to nothing." Why does that happen? Why does the wicked man's hope perish? Because all he hopes for is money and power, and when one is in the grave, one has no money and one has no power. Now, this implies that a righteous man does have hope when he dies, which is an inkling of the idea of eternal life in the Old Testament. Moving on to Proverbs 11:8, Solomon says, "The righteous man is rescued from trouble, and it comes on the wicked instead." How is the righteous man rescued, in this life or in the next life? Well, if it's in this life, then this is a general rule. The righteous man will be rescued. Think about how many times you have been rescued from trouble. I could count 1,000 times or so in my life, but that is a general rule. It's not true in every circumstance. Remember Hebrews 11. Certain prophets got sawn in two. They didn't get rescued from trouble. They had their goods taken away from them. They ended up in jail. So, not always. And we need to note, too, it doesn't say that the righteous man is prevented from ever having any trouble. He's rescued from trouble, which means he gets into trouble and then he gets out of it. It's like the doctrine of divine healing. It doesn't mean you never get sick. It means that when you do get sick, God will heal you. We go now to Proverbs 11:9. Solomon says, "With his mouth the godless destroys his neighbor, but through knowledge the righteous escape. Sticks and stones can hurt my bones, but words will never hurt me." Well, this proverb says the godless destroys his neighbor with his mouth, with his words. Words are terribly hurtful. Gossip, slander. People get bullied, little kids, and then they get bullied some more, and then they commit suicide. The law has defamation statutes. If you slander somebody or if you libel somebody, you can get taken to court and pay big damages. But through knowledge, the righteous escape. Wisdom has its benefits, escaping from trouble. We go to Proverbs 11:10. Solomon says, when the righteous prosper, the city rejoices. When the wicked perish, there are shouts of joy. Now we go from individual blessings for righteousness to corporate blessings for righteousness. The whole city rejoices when the righteous prosper. When the wicked perish, there are shouts of joy. Right now, I am living in a particular governmental and political arrangement, which is pretty disgusting. It's not as bad as China. When the wicked people who are controlling the culture and the politics of my country, when they perish, I, for one, will be shouting shouts of joy. And I'm sure there will be a lot of other people, too. I'm sure the same will be true in Xi Jinping's China also. Solomon knew about prosperity. He ran his kingdom very well, and Solomon's kingdom was the number one kingdom in the ancient Near East, which is pretty amazing considering he was surrounded by Assyria and Egypt and Syria, but they happened to be weak at the time that Solomon was strong, and so he was the top dog in the ancient Near East. Now, these shouts of joy when the wicked perish, a whole city shouting shouts of joy when the wicked perish, is seen in Revelation verses 20 through 21 of chapter 18. Rejoice over her, O heaven! Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets! God has judged her for the way she treated you. This is, of course, referring to Babylon the Great, which, in my humble opinion, refers to apostate Israel when it went down in AD 70. Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, with such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. Christians, rejoice when the wicked perish. We go now to verse 11 of Proverbs 11. Solomon continues, through the blessing of the upright, a city is exalted, but by the mouth of the wicked, it is destroyed. Now, how do the upright bless a city? This implies an active blessing, not just a happy thought, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out. So doing good for the corporate surroundings of a righteous person will exalt the city, either spiritually or temporally or both, but by the mouth of the wicked is destroyed by bringing the judgment of God on the city. There is a certain nation, of which I am a citizen, which is on the verge of being destroyed, if it's not dead already, because of the wicked who are in it, who will not repent. We go now to Proverbs 11, verse 12. Solomon continues in verse 12, a man who lacks judgment derides his neighbor, but a man of understanding holds his tongue. How does the man who lacks judgment deride his neighbor? Well, maybe the neighbor is poorer. Maybe the neighbor is less righteous than he is. But a man of understanding holds his tongue, i.e., when he sees his neighbor in a bad situation. In other words, a righteous man should never exhibit schadenfreude, glee, because an enemy is taken down. I wish that a certain ex-president of the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah, whose name I will not mention, it does rhyme with dump, I will tell you that, he loves to deride not only his neighbors, but his former political allies. Comes up with all kinds of nasty things to say about them, like the sanctimonious. He is not a man of understanding because he does not hold his tongue. It is best to conceal the defects of one's neighbor rather than trumpet them. We move now to Proverbs 11:13. Solomon continues, a gossip betrays a confident, but a trustworthy man keeps a secret. This proverb strikes me when I read it because I remember when I was in elementary school, I betrayed confidence. I forgot what the situation was, but I remember the fallout from it. People wouldn't talk to me anymore and said bad things about me, and I learned a big lesson then. Keep your mouth shut. How many of all these sins that Solomon has talked about in these first 11 chapters have to do with the tongue, the mouth, over and over again? Here's what Gill says about a gossip. He goes about with tales from place to place, who is like a walking merchant or peddler, as the word signifies, who takes up his wares at one place and exposes them to sale and vends them at another. So a tale-bearer, he goes from house to house and picks up tales at one place and carries them to another and tells them. And by his going about, he gets into the secrets of persons and families, or is entrusted with them. His character not being known, he reveals them to others, and so breaks the trust committed to him. Adam Clark says he is the walking busybody, the traitor in scandal. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says he is one trading as a peddler in scandal. This might remind us of Paul's admonition to Timothy when he says in 1 Timothy 5:13, besides they, referring to younger widows, they get into the habit of being idle and going about from house to house, and not only do they become idlers, but also gossips and busybodies, saying things they ought not to. We move now to Proverbs 11:14. Solomon continues, where there is no guidance, the people fall, but in an abundance of counselors there is victory. Why is that? Because what one counselor misses, another might hit upon. Here's some other scriptures saying the same thing by Solomon. Proverbs 15:22, without consultation, plans are frustrated, but with many counselors, they succeed. And again, that's a general rule. Sometimes you got good advice and things go wrong. This is the real world we live in. Proverbs 20:18, prepare plans by consultation and make war by wise guidance. Proverbs 24:6, for by wise guidance you will wage war, and in abundance of counselors there is victory. This reminds me of the great Otto von Bismarck, who, after accomplishing great things, unifying Germany, winning three wars, and all that, he decided that with his new empire, the Reich, the Second Reich, which came into being after 1870, after the Franco-Prussian War, Bismarck decided he didn't need any cabinet members. He was going to be the Reichskanzler, and he wasn't going to let anybody help him do it, and he almost killed himself. He was sick all the time. He was irritable. He raged all the time. He was vindictive. He was a real SOB, to be perfectly honest. Anti-Semitic, anti-free trade. Everybody hated his guts. He was a real piece of work. He's worth reading. If you ever find a good biography of Bismarck, read it, and you will see a lot of proverbs brought to life in the real world. Pride goes before a fall, for one example. An abundance of counselors, there is victory. Bismarck had no victories when he fell in 1890. All of his counselors had turned against him. We move now to Proverbs 11:15. Solomon says, he who puts up security for another will surely suffer, but whoever refuses to strike hands in pledge is safe. Striking hands in pledge is like shaking on it. And of course, a surety is when I agree to pay another person's debt that the other person owes when that other person defaults on the debt. Now, this putting up security for another presents us with a little ambiguity here. Who is the another? The KJV, the NASB, the ASV, Green's Literal Translation, Christian Standard Bible, and almost all the others' Bibles say a stranger. And so this admonition against securities is only applicable to giving securities to strangers, not neighbors or somebody that you know or family member. So that reading, stranger, which is in most of the translations, leaves open the possibility that it's okay of safely going surety for a friend or for a relative, or in business, because banks go surety for people with letters of credit. John Gill says that, and I think he's right, that this is not an absolute command not to enter into sureties, but is rather a prohibition against rash sureties. Here's what Gill says. It is a rash and inconsiderate entering into suretyship that is here cautioned against. Doing it without inquiring into and having sufficient knowledge of the person engaged for, and without considering whether able to answer the obligation if required, without hurting a man's self and family. Otherwise, suretyship may lawfully be entered into, and good be done by it, and no hurt to the surety himself and family. Well, I make this remark. A surety is a creditor. There's nothing wrong with lending money. Nothing wrong with charging interest, assuming, of course, it's not a charity loan under the Old Testament law. But in general, you charge interest for a loan. Nobody thinks you're an evil person for doing that. Here are my thoughts on how you can make a case for a sensible surety agreement. First, you rationally weigh out the risk. You know you can stand the hit if the debtor can't pay the creditor and you've got to pay the debt. Well, that's okay. It's not going to bankrupt you. Or do you have a good reason for doing it? Are you in business and expect to get paid for it? Okay. Or if it's a family member, you want to do a good turn, like when parents go surety on a car loan for their kid so that he can get to school. Also, another factor that might make you want to enter into a reasonable surety agreement is if you will not expect to get paid back from the defaulted debtor. Also, another factor which might make you more inclined to enter into a surety agreement is if you will not expect to get paid back from the defaulted debtor and you are willing to consider the payment of the surety as a gift to the debtor. Now, I mentioned that most of the translations assume the person you're going surety for is a stranger. However, We need to look at Proverbs 6:1. My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor or entered into an agreement with a stranger, most of the translations have neighbor in parallel with stranger, and generally with that parallelism there, you assume that the neighbor is the same person as the stranger, but it can't be because a neighbor's not going to be a stranger. So in Proverbs 6:1, Solomon says, don't put up security for your neighbor. That's not a stranger, so that might cut against what I just said about it's okay to do it with a neighbor. Proverbs 6:1 says, don't do it for your neighbor. Well, I suppose at the very least, that means you could get yourself in trouble putting up surety for a neighbor. He could become your enemy if you are resentful when he doesn't pay his debt and you have to pay it. You better go through those suggestions I just said as to when you give a surety. We do know that you are perfectly safe if you don't give the surety at all. At the end of verse 15, Proverbs 11, Solomon says, whoever refuses to strike hands in pledge is safe. And that's true. You want to be perfectly safe? Don't go surety. I tend to be more absolutist on that pledge. I don't believe in going surety for anybody. I don't believe in lending money to friends. I did one time, several thousand dollars, when I said, if you don't pay me back, it's a gift. He never paid me back. We're still good friends. I gave it to him. We go now to Proverbs 11:16. A kind-hearted woman gains respect, but ruthless men gain only wealth. Of course, that's ungodly wealth and no respect. Now, this respect that a kind-hearted woman gains, is it respect for herself, respect for her husband, or respect both for herself and for her husband? Clark says it's respect for her husband. A good wife is an honor to her husband, and a bad wife is her husband's reproach, says Clark. So all you single guys out there, you want to marry somebody because she's cute, she's pretty, but she's arrogant and mean. I'll never forget the time a fellow business professor of mine told me about all the lawsuits he was engaged in with his ex-wife. And finally, after hearing this, I said, why did you ever marry this woman? She sounds like a witch. And he immediately said, because she was pretty. He learned his lesson. He was young and dumb at the time he married her. We go now to Proverbs 11:17. Solomon says this, a kind man benefits himself, but a cruel man brings trouble on himself. How does a kind man benefit himself? By improving his moral feeling, says Adam Clark. But a cruel man brings trouble on himself, probably because people will react against that and try to do him in. Adam Clark says, a cruel man frets his flesh off his bones. Clark also says, we seldom see a peevish, fretful, vindictive man either in good health. Now, Otto von Bismarck, whom I have previously mentioned, is the perfect example of this. He was sick all the time. Whenever he lost a confrontation with William I, the emperor, he would go to bed. Worry. He constantly worried. He was paranoid. He thought everybody was after him. He was vindictive. He shafted his friends till he had no friends left. A cruel man brings trouble on himself, Otto. We go now to Proverbs 11:18. Solomon says, the wicked man earns deceptive wages, but he who sows righteousness reaps a sure reward. Why are the wicked man's wages deceptive? Because they don't last. In fact, the Holman Christian Study Bible translates deceptive as empty. The wicked man earns empty wages. They don't mean a thing. Proverbs 22:8, Solomon wrote this, he who sows iniquity will reap vanity, and the rod of his fury will perish. What you reap are your wages, and Proverbs 22:8 says that the wicked man will reap vanity, which means nothing. Something that's in vain means it's nothing, it's not there. All is vanity and chasing after the wind. The man who sows righteousness reaps a sure reward. There's all kinds of rewards, one of which is the reward of knowing the truth. We go now to Proverbs 11:19. The truly righteous man, says Solomon, attains life, but he who pursues evil goes to his death. So righteousness does indeed have its rewards, even though sometimes the righteous do suffer. Now, of course, this righteousness is not referring to merely outward righteous acts, but righteous acts of the heart. Here's some relevant scriptures. Solomon says in Proverbs 11, verses 5 through 6, the righteousness of the blameless will smooth his way, but the wicked will fall by his own wickedness. The righteousness of the upright will deliver them, but the treacherous will be caught by their own greed. That, of course, is in our chapter here, chapter 11. I've already read those verses just a little while ago. In the previous chapter, Proverbs 10, verse 16, Solomon says, the wages of the righteous is life, the income of the wicked, punishment. The man who pursues evil, says Solomon in verse 19, goes to his death. That could be temporal death, it could be eternal death, or both. as John Gill says. We go now to Proverbs 11:20. Solomon says, "The Lord detests men of perverse heart, but he delights in those whose ways are blameless." A perverse heart is one that's contrary to the laws of nature and contrary to the laws of God. God detests those men. You know, people sometimes ask, well, can a loving God ever hate anybody? Well, what does this say here? The Lord detests, not just hates, but detests men of perverse heart. And you could say, well, then nobody's going to be saved because he detests us all. Well, he detests the evil that they're doing, but if they're in the elect, he's going to get rid of that evil by forgiving it through the redemptive atonement of Christ. And faith in that, which applied to Old Testament people too, when they had faith in those sacrifices, they were looking forward to the sacrifice of Jesus. But until then, God hates you. You are his enemy. You are not his friend until you accept Christ. Verse 21, Proverbs 11, Solomon says, "Assuredly, the evil man will not go unpunished, but the descendants of the righteous will be delivered." Notice how deliverance passes down the generations. And that really is true. You take somebody that's had a decent, sound upbringing, their life is so much easier and so much better and so much more blessed than the person who has been raised chaotically and abusively. I just heard the story of a Christian woman, dedicated Christian, marrying somebody who's basically a non-Christian. If she had had Christian parents, she probably wouldn't be doing that. I also remember the head of a Christian organization that produced Christian school curriculum said that most missionaries are third-generation Christians, that the righteousness of the grandfather, the grandparents, and the parents had built an ethic of service to God in Christ's kingdom that passed all the way down to the third generation. And then the third generation was ready to be a missionary, which of course is a very difficult thing to do. We move now to Proverbs 11:22. Solomon says, "As a ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a beautiful woman who lacks discretion." This is one of my favorite proverbs. I wish I'd thought of this proverb to tell my business professor friend who married that beautiful woman who ended up suing him every time he turned around. Now, you look at a pig, and you look at his nose, he's got a ring of gold in it. It's strange, because usually it was an iron ring that was put into a pig's nose, not a golden ring. So it's inappropriate. The purpose of that iron ring was to keep the pig from rooting up the earth. Pigs love to root, as you know. But likewise, women, just like pigs, they like to put nose rings into their nose back then. So we have a situation that's out of whack in two ways. First of all, pigs shouldn't be wearing golden rings. And second of all, beautiful women shouldn't be wandering around like pigs. And that's what they're doing. Because a beautiful woman who lacks discretion is referring to someone who is unchaste, as John Gill says. She's lost all sense of modesty and chastity, forsaken her husband, and given up herself to the embraces of others. She's pretty like the ring of gold, but she's wallowing in the impurities of lust. We move now to Proverbs 11:23. Solomon says, "The desire of the righteous is only good, but the expectation of the wicked is wrath." Now, this proverb is a little bit ambiguous. The desire of the righteous is only good. That could be interpreted this way. The desire of the righteous is only to do good, as John Gill suggests. But it also could be interpreted this way. The desire of the righteous is only to receive good things from God. It just says it's only good. To do good or to receive good? Well, the last half of the couplet is, "But the expectation of the wicked is wrath." That's something the wicked receive. So if we go by Hebrew parallelism, which of course is not 100% to be applied, the first part of the couplet is talking about receiving also. So the desire of the righteous would be to receive good. The expectation of the wicked is to receive wrath. And I think that makes a lot of sense. So if you're righteous, you believe in God, if you believe God and it was reckoned to you as righteousness, then what you desire is only good things. You can expect good things. Again, going with parallelism here, the expectation of the wicked is wrath, the expectation of the righteous is good things are going to happen to you. And of course, the wrath that the wicked expects is the wrath of God. We go now to Proverbs 11:24. "There is one who scatters and yet increases all the more. And there is one who withholds what is justly due, and yet it results only in want." For scatters, the NIV has gives freely, the NESB has scatters. There is one who gives freely and yet increases all the more. You can't outgive God, you give, God gives you back. It's just the way a sovereign God takes care of his people, but he expects you to share in his nature, which is a generous nature, a giving nature. He gave his only begotten son. And there is one who withholds what is justly due, and it results only in want. The opposite of giving is to be a skinflint, a stingy person. Now notice that this stingy person withholds what is justly due. That might refer to people who owe money on a contract or a wage contract. Well, you skimp with your workers, you'll go out of business, your company will suffer. You will be in want eventually. A generous person is blessed. Some other scriptures saying that, Luke 6:38, give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, how much you use, it will be measured back to you. This refers to the fact that people would carry grain in the folds of their shirt in the front, and when they received the grain, the person giving them the grain would press it down, and then they would shake the grain together to let it sink down so more could be put into the recipient's bosom. Solomon says in Proverbs 28, verse 27, he who gives to the poor will never want, but he who shuts his eyes will have many curses. There are so many Bible verses about giving, I don't even want to take the time to list them all. We go now to Proverbs 11:25. Solomon says, the generous man will be prosperous, and he who waters will himself be watered. Well, I just said there are many scriptures talking about generosity. The very next proverb talks about generosity. It is more blessed to give than to receive. You water, you'll be watered. The generous man will be prosperous. We go now to Proverbs 11:26. Solomon says, he who withholds grain, the people will curse him, but blessing will be on the head of him who sells it. Now, this is referring to times of famine or scarcity or disaster when markets are not functioning normally. And during those times, people will try to withhold the scarce commodity so that the price will shoot up and people will pay him a fortune for it. And, of course, people will curse you if you do that. Adam Clark says God will probably add his curses to the curses of the people, or to the curses of the poor man who can't afford the commodity, the wheat, or whatever it is. The curses of the other people who observe the selfishness of the hoarder, they will be added. Solomon says in Proverbs 28, verse 27, he who gives to the poor will never want, but he who shuts his eyes will have many curses. This reminds me, one time there was a hurricane, all the power was out, and I had a relative who was an electrician, and he told me about all the fees electricians were charging to hook people's power up, and it was astonishing at how much the price had gone up. But my relative electrician charged the normal price, and I know God blessed him for it, for doing that. I admired him for doing that. I would have had a hard time not wanting to jack my price up just a little bit. Blessing will be on the head of him who sells the grain. Now, this is, of course, assuming the grain is sold at a moderate price so that the poor can afford it. We go now to Proverbs 11, verse 27. Solomon continues, the one who searches for what is good finds favor, but if someone looks for trouble, it will come to him. Now, this is searching for the good of other people, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. And if you look at the parallel nature of the couplet here, you got the bad person looking for trouble, so you got the good person looking for the opposite of trouble, which is favor. So the evil person is looking to trouble other people, and the good person is seeking to favor the other person. That's one way of looking at it. The other way you could look at it is say the one who searches for what is good, not for other people, but for himself. And he searches for what is good for himself by being wise. But if someone looks for trouble by being evil, it comes to him. I don't know which way it should be taken. I'll report, you decide. We move now to Proverbs 11:28. Solomon says, he who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like the green leaf. While will the man who trusts in his riches fall? Because riches are here today and gone tomorrow. And plus, you can't take it with you when you go, so you're going to fall at least at that time. But the righteous will flourish like the green leaf. Green leaves are full of fruit. Let's look at some other scriptures that say that. Psalms 1:3, he will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, referring to the person who takes delight in the Lord's instruction. He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and whatever he does, he prospers. So green leaves are symbols of prosperity. Jeremiah 17:8, for he will be like a tree planted by the water, referring to the one who trusts in the Lord. He will be like a tree planted by the water that extends its roots by a stream and will not fear when the heat comes, but its leaves will be green. And it will not be anxious, this tree, in a year of drought, nor cease to yield fruit. That reminds me of the title of Isabel Kuhn's autobiography. I think it was her autobiography, a book about her, called Green Leaf in Drought Time. I didn't realize that it came from Jeremiah 17:8 until just now. It's a fantastic book, fantastic missionary. Isabel Kuhn, go read her biography if you want to get inspired. We move now to Proverbs 11:29. Solomon says, "He who troubles his own house will inherit wind, and the foolish will be servant to the wise-hearted." Well, if you inherit wind, you've inherited nothing because you can't spend it, you can't touch it. It destroys things. It's a lousy inheritance. The person who troubles his own house will get such an inheritance, as John Gill says, by being bitter to the one and by provoking the others to wrath and continually giving out menacing words to the rest, or through idleness, not providing for his family, or through an overworldly spirit, pushing on business and hurrying it on beyond measure, or through a niggardly and avaricious temper, withholding meat and drink and clothes convenient for them. He who troubles his own house, that would include a man's wife, his children, his servants. I think of Otto von Bismarck, who's on my mind these days. He had a son who wanted to marry a noblewoman who was very beautiful and apparently was a pretty good wife. She went down to Venice to wait for him, so he would go down there to marry her, and his father was all upset because she was related to some of his political enemies, and so Otto von Bismarck told his son, Bill Bismarck, no, 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 you don't go down there, and the son stood up his fiancé and refused to go down there. He was miserable the rest of his life, single the rest of his life. He drank and drank and drank and drank himself to death. He died at the age of 55, I think it was. And he was bitter and mean. His life was ruined. His father ruined him. The foolish will be servant to the wise-hearted. The fool will lose all his money and thus will have to hire out to somebody with money. In other words, he'll have to sell himself as a slave or as a worker. To the wise-hearted, people with wisdom are usually more prosperous. We go now to Proverbs 11:30. Solomon says, "The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, and he who is wise wins souls." This sentiment is expressed by Solomon also in Proverbs 3:18. She, referring to wisdom, the personified wisdom, is a tree of life to those who embrace her, and those who hold on to her are happy. So you get life when you embrace wisdom, hold on to her. And the fruit that you bear is the same fruit that a tree of life bears, a tree bearing fruit, and that fruit is life. That's sort of how the metaphors go. You're righteous, and you're going to bear fruit, and that fruit is going to tend to life in your life and everybody else's life. And at the end of verse 30, Solomon says, "He who is wise wins souls." That sounds like a witnessing verse, but that's not what Solomon meant, of course. He meant that a wise person wins people to himself, brings favor on himself. However, that's true, but we could apply this verse to winning souls to favor God rather than favoring Solomon or favoring the wise person. It is not wise to merely sit back and let people go on their way to destruction. We should try to win them over to the truth. So he who is wise wins souls either to the wise person or to wisdom itself or to life itself or to righteousness, whatever. You try to win people over. Now, that's tricky when you're witnessing to people who hate your guts and who hate God and who've suppressed the truth and unrighteousness. But, you know, if you just be nice to people and say, "Really? Tell me what your views are." And then you can start working on witnessing to them. But I tell you, people are not going to listen to you unless you're nice to them. I remember when I was in China, I would always help students. They always wanted to come to America to study, and I would write or help them write. I should be very careful to say help them write their personal statements and their applications. And when you do that, they appreciate it and they will listen to me. Now, some of them didn't accept Christ, but some of them did. You don't know who's going to do it, who's going to become a disciple just because you help them. But the more you help people, the more they're willing to listen. I can speak to personal experience there. We go now to the last verse, The last proverb in chapter 11, Solomon says this in verse 31, "If the righteous will be rewarded in the earth, how much more the wicked and the sinner?" Now, what does it mean when Solomon says the righteous will be rewarded? Well, it could be that the righteous are rewarded with good things because of their righteousness. John Gill suggests it could be the righteous are rewarded with bad things for their chastisement and direction. I do not believe that's what Solomon meant. I don't think people say that chastisement is a good thing without really warning you and explaining that, because people don't like chastisement. I mean, it is true. Chastisement is a reward, but I don't think that's what Solomon's saying here. So the righteous will be rewarded in the earth, and of course this is not in heaven now, this is on the earth. How much more the wicked and the sinner? They're going to be rewarded in this life as well as the one to come. Now, of course, again, why do the wicked prosper? They don't always prosper. The wicked get rewarded in this life. And this is a general rule, not necessarily true all the time. Now, that more there, how much more the wicked and the sinner will be rewarded, that could refer to more punishment in this life, or it could be referring to eternal hell, which is added to whatever punishment they might have gotten in this life. Now, of course, if you take that, how much more punishment, i.e. hell, the wicked will receive, that takes care of the problem of why do the wicked prosper. But the problem of why do the wicked prosper is answered by yours truly this way. They only prosper temporarily, even in this life. They usually end up in jail or riddled with disease or something terrible. Read their biographies. I used to love to read the biographies of these captains of industry, these robber barons and all these rich people. Oh my gosh. Or how about royalty? British royalty or the royalty of any European country? Oh my gosh. I'd rather be dead than be one of those people. They get rewarded with a horrible life. So they prosper. Bismarck prospered. I'd rather be dead than have to live a life like Bismarck. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that this sentiment or this statement that the wicked and the sinner will be rewarded in this life, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, this is confirmed, quote, even in time, not excluding future rewards and punishment. In other words, the wicked and the sinner will be punished more than the righteous will be rewarded. That might refer to hell, but even if you leave hell out of it and just refer to life on this planet, the wicked are going to get theirs. Now, before we leave chapter 11, I want to make one more comment. The Septuagint translates verse 31 differently than the NASB translation I just mentioned. NASB says, if the righteous will be rewarded in the earth, how much more the wicked and the sinner? The Septuagint says, and if the righteous scarcely be saved, not rewarded in the earth, but scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? This scarcely be saved is kind of interesting wording. What does that mean? Peter, of course, using the Septuagint, says this in 1 Peter 4:18, and if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Well, if we take that translation, that it's difficult for righteous people to either be rewarded in Proverbs 11 or saved in the New Testament in 1 Peter 4, it means that God has to do a lot in order to reward us and to get us saved. He has to do an awful lot. So ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Proverbs 11, and we are prepared to go to Proverbs 12. Solomon will continue with his Proverbs. We will call the next audio Proverbs of Solomon Part 3. I hope you stay tuned for some more wisdom, and I hope you enjoyed the wisdom that was contained in Chapter 11 in this audio.